Pushkin.
I thought, this is it, man. Los Angeles. Yeah. Quincy says, you know, I'd rather live in Los Angeles than heaven.
That's T-Bone Burnett in conversation with my broken record partner, Rick Rubin. We took a hilarious picture of Rick and T-Bone after they taped this interview. Rick is in a t-shirt and shorts, naturally. T-Bone towers over him, dressed impeccably in a white shirt and a black suit, like some old-school blues player. I think of T-Bone as Rick's spiritual godfather. He's a generation older, in his early 70s, but he's had the same kind of extraordinary behind-the-scenes influence on the music we all listen to. T-Bone is probably most famous for helping launch the careers of artists like Los Lobos, Counting Crows, and Gillian Welch. Also for producing albums by Brandi Carlile, Elton John, and the masterfully executed Raising Sand collaboration between Alison Krauss and Robert Plant. Oh, he also produced and performed on my favorite Elvis Costello record of all time, King of America. Then there's his film and TV credits, which are insane. He partnered with the Coen brothers as music supervisor on The Big Lebowski. He worked on Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, Walk the Line, Crazy Heart, True Detective. The list goes on. He's a new record out called The Invisible Light Acoustic Space, available wherever you get your music. It's the first in a series of records T-Bone will be putting out this year, an incredible outpouring of songs coming out of a play he's providing the music for. I only met him once, years and years ago, at what was the most star-studded dinner party I've ever attended. It was in L.A. I got invited by accident. It was wall-to-wall movie stars and T-Bone Burnett. And the only person I wanted to listen to was T-Bone Burnett. You're about to understand how I felt. I'm Malcolm Gladwell. This is Broken Record. And I'm heartbroken I didn't get to join in on this conversation. Here in conversation at Shangri-La Studios in Malibu, Rick Rubin and T-Bone Burnett.
Are you always writing songs?
No, you know, I took a job about 3 years ago. Marshall Brickman. Do you know Marshall Brickman?
Yeah.
Incredible character. He was one of the original folkies in New York City.
And, I didn't know that. I only know him as a writer.
Well, in the 50s, he was one of the cats in Washington Square Park. And he played on Judy Collins records. He was a session musician. He played banjo and fiddle and guitar and mandolin. He was the guitar player on Dueling Banjos for Deliverance. And by the time he was 23, he was the head writer on the Johnny Carson Tonight Show. And then he invented the Dick Cavett Show. And then he wrote those movies with Woody Allen that you would know, Annie Hall in Manhattan.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he wrote Jersey Boys, which is a...
Amazing.
Yeah, you know, so he's transitioned into theater, and he called me up and he said, do you want to write a musical about the people who played Roy Rogers and Dale Evans? And do you remember them at all?
Yeah.
So Roy Rogers was, for my generation, the biggest star in the world. You know, all through the 50s, he had a television show. Mm. And it was an interesting idea. He's in the Country Music Hall of Fame because he was a fantastic singer. But I always thought he was Roy Rogers, and I always thought Dale Evans was Dale Evans, but they were two actors.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, nobody knows that. So this is a story about the people who played them. And
so they were like the monkeys?
Yeah, a little bit, yeah. Except she wrote Happy Trails. She was a great songwriter.
Wow.
And he was a great singer.
But they were cast into those parts.
Yeah.
And the whole character was a made-up character.
Yeah, the whole character was a made-up character.
Unbelievable.
And I brought a song to play for you.
Do you want to play me the song?
Yeah.
I'm excited to hear the song.
Yeah. Everybody wants to know the truth, but nobody wants to hear it. Everybody has to face the end, but nobody wants to get near it. Everybody wants peace, but nobody wants to surrender. Everyone lives in the past, but nobody seems to remember. There is nothing as long as never. As everything burns, it grows cold. Everybody wants to live forever, but nobody wants to get old. Everybody wants to be forgiven, but nobody wants to confess. Everyone longs to hold on to a moment that no one can ever possess. Everyone wants to be free, but no one can pay the price. Everyone wants to be heard when no one has asked for advice. There is nothing as long as never. As everything burns, it grows cold. Everybody wants to live forever, but nobody wants to get old. Nobody knows the end of the story. We must wait for it to unfold. Everyone lives facing memento mori, but nobody wants to get old. Nobody wants to get old. That's a nice
Yeah. Where will that fall into the story?
I don't know. I think it's early on when he's, I think he's maybe auditioning for a radio show or something. He sings that song. Mm. But yeah, I think it's in the first act.
Great.
Yeah.
Really good.
Thank you.
Do you have to write, are you at a point now where you know sort of where the songs fit? And is there ever a calling to like say, okay, in the end of the second act, we need to add a song in this spot, and this is what it needs to accomplish in the story?
Yeah. In fact, I just wrote, we did they call it a 29-hour reading, which is you get all the actors up on their feet and they read the parts, and you do it without costumes or without sets, but you get the gist of it, the tempo of the thing. And I realized after the last one, I didn't have a beginning song for Roy and I didn't have an ending song for Dale. So I went back and I did that. I wrote a good song called Out of Nowhere for Roy to start off with, so you meet him in strength. And then Dale needed a song at the end, a heavy duty number at the end. So yeah, and I'm sure we're gonna open it in Atlanta in 2020, in the fall of 2020, and I'm sure once we get into the process of really getting it up and getting it in front of audiences, there'll be a lot more changes to come.
Yeah. Beautiful. I love the peace and surrender line. It's really good.
Really good. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, and I love the tagline. The hook line is great.
Yeah, everybody wants to live forever, but nobody wants to get old.
So good. So good.
But when I accepted this commission, to write these songs for a musical. And I'd done a lot of work with Sam Shepard. He and I had done a lot of things for plays. But a musical's different because every line has to be intentional. You know, you can't write just
it's
cool sounding.
Yeah. It's narrative.
Yeah, it is narrative. And it became, it sobered me up quite a bit. And I read Sondheim's books and I started studying Frank Lesser, who I think was the greatest of all the Broadway composers, and Lerner and Lowe and all these cats. And it became clear that I was going to have to dance or get off the floor. Yeah. So I started waking up every morning at 4 a.m. for about a year, solid, and writing when it was quiet. And then when I got through writing the 20 songs for the musical, I couldn't stop writing. So I've written now, I don't know how many, we've recorded about 2 hours of music.
Fantastic.
That we're going to start putting out at April 12th.
Is the process of writing a song for a musical different than writing a song otherwise?
Yeah, it is, because it does have to move the story along. But
do you start with the music first, or do you start with the lyric first?
I started with the lyrics, because it's, as you say, it's part of the book. It's part of the narrative.
So you'd write it like a poem, basically.
Yeah.
Would you have a melody in your head?
Yeah, yeah. You know, melody is really just codified inflection. So it's your storytelling no matter what. Mm-hmm. So every sentence has a certain melody to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was doing that. I was writing, but I would have a sense of the melody as it was going down. And then, you know, I wrote, we're starting to put out records. I'm putting out 3 double records in the next year, this year.
Wow.
I'm going to kind of work hip hop, because I see these cats, they just put stuff out constantly. Yeah. So we've recorded a lot of these tunes that have come afterward.
Yes.
I really stopped producing other people for the most part, although.
Interesting.
I just made a record with Sarah Bareilles that's really beautiful.
I'd love to hear that.
She's a beautiful singer.
Unbelievable.
And she's also gone through the experience of writing a play. She wrote a musical of Waitress. And it raised the stakes for her, too. Her writing has become much more resonant, deeper, and higher. It's interesting to hear her growth through the process.
Mm-hmm. How is a collaboration with her different than her other records, would you say?
We did it more live, which is what I mostly do. That's the thing I like most. The thing I love about making records is when people are playing and singing all at one time. They get finished, and you say, yeah, that's great. You know.
It's such a great feeling. It's such a, there's something about people playing together that no amount of getting it right counters the energy of the interaction.
That's
of
right.
People really playing.
Yeah, perfection is a second-rate idea.
For sure.
And the computer is able to put out perfect music all day long, but it's not nearly as interesting. It's like those Johnny Cash records you made with him just sitting in a room with some people, turning them on to a song, you know, and turning the whole world onto the song the same way. Yeah. So that's the process I like the most. And I think the band was great. She, you know, it was essentially the same band that was on Raising Sand. Jay Bellarose played drums, and Dennis Crouch played string bass, and Rebo played guitar.
I love that album so much.
That Raising Sand record?
I love it.
Isn't that a beautiful
it's
record?
It's so beautiful.
Yeah.
It really took me by surprise. Yeah, I don't know why. I wasn't expecting it to be so beautiful, and just blew my mind.
Well, you know, both of them have mystical, beautiful voices.
Yes.
And it was interesting to hear him soften up.
Yeah, but on paper, it wasn't necessarily a must-listen thing.
Yeah, right.
And then hearing it was mind-blowing.
Yeah.
I didn't know most of those songs, so I didn't know that they weren't original songs.
Yeah, so they were original for most people.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
But it's got some of that same.
Beautiful.
Sarah's record has some of that same.
How did that one come together?
Robert Nelson?
Yes.
Really, I think Bill Flanagan, you know Flanagan,
don't
you? Flanagan was doing that show, Crossroads, and I think he wanted to do a Crossroads with Robert and Allison, and it ended up being a record, and then we did a Crossroads later, but I think they met from that idea of Flanagan pitching them on doing it. They met, and they did a tribute to Leadbelly or somebody up in Cleveland, I think, and they enjoyed it. And then they called me up and said, "Do you want to make a record?" And I sent them those 2 Gene Clark songs. Those are the first 2 things I sent them.
Yeah.
Through the Morning, Through the Night, and Polly, which I thought had that Gene had that dark mystical vibe that they both have. You know, it's interesting now to hear Robert sing low and soft like that, and go back and listen to Led Zeppelin.
It was so beautiful. It really showed another side. And it felt like a side that just the timing of it was right for him. You know, like to hear him sound like that was a revelation.
Yeah. Well, he sounded like a grown man.
Yeah. Made sense.
When before, I mean, he says himself that the early Led Zeppelin records, he sounded like a castrato or something. Yeah. You know, he was singing so high.
Yeah. And I'd imagine that when he sings like that now, it's more like he's imitating the old him, whereas Raising Sand sounds like more believable now.
Yeah, I don't I really don't think he could sing those songs. He couldn't sing them in the range he used to sing them in, you know. Same with Elton. You know, Elton's voice has dropped a good octave or something like that. And he's got this beautiful, deep, resonant baritone now. And you listen to some of the old records, he sounds like he's on helium or something after getting used to his voice now and loving it and going back and hearing them. Not that they aren't absolutely classic and great. Same for Zeppelin.
Was there any reason you didn't do a second one with a follow-up to Raising Sand?
I don't know.
I
think we may do one of these days.
I would love that.
Maybe we should do one.
Great.
Maybe we should do it together.
Let's do it. It's such a beautiful album.
Yeah. I would love to do one again. We went in and recorded some songs, and having been through all the success, so to speak, the stakes seemed different when we went on in the second time.
Understood.
And it didn't feel, I don't think any of us felt the same kind of freedom that we'd felt
so
the first
time. Isn't it interesting how the stakes changed the whole process?
Yeah. Yeah, so but I think now it's been long enough, so we probably could go in and just play. Just play, you know.
That'd be great. Do you have ideas of songs?
I hadn't thought about it that much. I mean, there've just been rumblings about it. So we'll see where it goes.
Have you done any other collaborations like that where it's been two artists who don't normally work together?
I don't think I have. Mm. Have you done that?
Can't remember. I can't remember.
I've done quite a few. You know, the Rolling Thunder Review, which was this studio was part of that whole time.
Yes.
That was a beautiful experiment. And it was a master class in art and show business. I mean, there was Allen Ginsberg and Ann Waldman were there. Sam Shepard was there. There were incredible musicians. Joni Mitchell was there. Joan Baez. Yeah. And Howie Wyeth and David Mansfield, one great musician after another, Mick Ronson.
Mick Ronson was part of it.
Yeah, people from all different parts of the world and different disciplines and different places. But everybody came together and collaborated, and it was a tremendous learning experience that I've replicated or tried to replicate several times with like the Roy Orbison Black and White Night show. And
that was incredible too.
That was a beautiful evening.
Incredible.
And I saw it the other day. I was watching it. Leonard Cohen was in the audience. I'd forgotten that. I think that idea of like Aerosmith and Run DMC, did you have anything to do with that?
I suppose so. I forgot.
Yeah.
It's hard to think, you know what I mean? It's hard to think about projects.
Yeah, I know, exactly.
It's all just sort of...
It's hard to even look back at all.
For sure, and I rarely do.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. But that was certainly one of those, that changed everything.
Yeah.
And
people
the Beastie Boys changed, you know, them doing I'm Down.
Yeah, did you ever hear that?
Oh, yeah.
Because it never came out.
It never did.
No. We couldn't get permission. It was supposed to be on that first album, License to Ill. Might have been the last thing we recorded for it. We couldn't get permission, and it never came out. But I think it's on like YouTube or somewhere.
I heard it. Steve Rubofsky played
me.
Because he was
our A&R guy. Yeah.
Yeah, and it was. I'm really D. You know.
Fully D.
I'm fully D.
I remember.
That's right.
Yeah. So funny.
So funny, man. Yeah. They were cutting up.
Yeah, I did that. I did the guitar solo and the organ solo. Neither are instruments that I really play, and it really shows. You know, it's like.
When we come back, T-Bone premieres another brand new song for us. But first, we pay the bills. We're back. And T-Bone has another new song to play for us called Out of Nowhere, another number from the Roy Rogers and Dale Evans musical he's writing for.
This is the song I realized I needed a song to introduce Roy.
Yes.
I didn't really have a powerful number to introduce him. And as I said, the guy who played him, Leonard Sly, was a soulful, beautiful cat. He wasn't at all like the swashbuckling cowboy. You know, he was different. And so I wanted to write something from inside him, not about him.
Yes.
But for something that he was feeling about his life and about where he came from. So this is a song called Out of Nowhere. There is no end to this road we travel. No conclusion is foregone. Once you define a thing, you lose it, but it keeps you moving on. No battle that can be won is worth fighting. There is no place to run but between the lightning. No grievous talisman, no specter frightening, can stop the wind from blowing, can stop the river flowing, can stop the world from turning, can stop the sun from burning. So I'm never gonna quit, 'cause when you're not expecting it, good things happen. Stay. If you don't, I'll go away. Where I'll go, it's hard to say. Once you define a thing, you lose it, but it keeps you moving on. It keeps you moving on. Back to that idea you were talking about the way art happens.
Yeah.
Right. Once you define a thing, you lose it.
Yeah. It's hard. It's really hard.
Yeah.
It's really hard.
That's right.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's, I think in retrospect, after the moment of inspiration where the thing that wants to be revealed is revealed and we know we like it.
Yeah.
Then we can maybe try to figure out why we like it. And you know, and then yeah. It's okay.
Yeah.
But I think the other way around is very difficult.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I don't know if it even happens.
I don't know.
Yeah, what I think artists do, I think all really artists do, is we're going down a road and we mark things. We say, at this day, I was at this place and I saw this thing and it was beautiful.
Yes.
And so I'm going to mark this so that maybe you don't miss it when you're going by. I think that's the real journey of an artist. You know? Yeah,
I can remember seeing French impressionist paintings of trees in the French countryside and thinking it's a very strange decision that the artist is making, you know, putting all these different blotches of color to make the tree. It's very poetic and beautiful, but it's, you know, what a wild imagination. And then I went to France and I saw the trees. It's like, oh, that's what they actually look like. You know what I mean? Yeah, it's like, it seemed like the lyrics of songs hit us in this sort of poetic, magical way. When often if we hear the story of them, they turn out to be very ordinary descriptions of what really happened.
Yeah. Right on.
I guess maybe it's the information that's left out that makes them seem so magical.
Yeah, I think that's right. I do think that's an interesting observation. I do think that's right.
In this song that you just sang, the hook has a repetition of a phrase. The first song you played did not have that.
Right.
Isn't it interesting that when writing words, that certain words can be repeated often and it feels really good, and other words you repeat them and it feels like you can never repeat them.
Right. Some things become a chant.
Yeah. And they fall in really naturally.
Yeah, it's the melody of the thought. It's the melody of the expression.
Yeah, maybe the phrasing as well. The way they work rhythmically. Interesting.
You're pretty good at this, you know. That's very interesting. Never thought of it at all.
Me either. I'm thinking of it right now.
Oh, it's really? Like, yeah, yeah. It's wild.
Part of the conversation. Good. It's what's coming out from listening to the song. It's like,
excellent.
How does that work? How do we do that? I've noticed the difficulty in it, but I've never thought about why.
Yeah. But that one, this one here, I don't know. That's just something that became very important to me, that idea. And it was important in context. It was important for Roy Rogers because for him, everything just happened out of nowhere.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
So it was important for him to embrace that idea. But then it happened. I mean, the Raising Sand record happened out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Right? Just
I think the best things do.
Yeah, that's right.
They really do.
They're not conceived or exactly. They're just they're helped into existence.
Yeah,
loved into existence.
And the intention behind them is a beautiful intention.
Yeah.
But the intention didn't control it happening. It's more like maybe it allowed it to be revealed.
Maybe just got it rolling in the first place.
Yeah.
Right.
And also in the first song, if we were making a record together and if I was producing it, I would have suggested repeating the tag at the end of the first piece.
I'll do that next time.
Well, it depends though, because in the context of it, and I was specific about if we were making a record together, it would be the purpose of the song would be different than the way it would be in a play.
Oh, that's right.
So like in a play, I don't know. I was thinking about it. It's like the structure in a play might be different than a normal song structure. It wants to accomplish a different purpose.
And we won't know until we get it up and we're playing 100%, it for people.
100%. Yeah, I think the idea of making art, like you were saying earlier about on the Raising Sand album, the stakes got high and then it changed because there was an expectation. I like to say, and I have said it before to artists that I've worked with, is when we're making these things, the audience comes last.
That's what I think, too. I agree. Yeah. I don't believe you can do it for the audience.
No, because I don't think we're... I know that if we can make something that we like, there's a better chance that someone else is going to like it than if we make what that we don't like, but we think someone else is going to like.
Yeah.
That seems impossible.
That's one of the problems with, you know, working in television is... There are a lot of people that think they know what the audience wants, and they're always trying to get you to do the thing the audience wants. And television's a big collaborative medium. And, you know, I love to collaborate, and I love to collaborate with large groups, but it's not a process of starting with the audience and then working backward.
Not at all. Not if you want to make something good.
Right. And what audiences like is something good.
Absolutely.
So your real obligation or responsibility to the artist is to make a thing you really love.
100%.
If you do that,
yes,
then there's a really good chance they'll really love it as well.
Hopefully.
So
hopefully. At least your best chance.
Yeah, at least you got a chance.
Yeah.
And I feel like as a record producer, I often feel like a proxy for the audience.
Me too. Same.
Right?
Same. I'm not really a musician, so all I am is a glorified fan.
You know, listener.
That's really what I am.
Well, you're a listener.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
I listen and I try to understand. I can tune into what pulls me into something and what pushes me away.
Yeah.
And I just really trust whatever that is.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
I never know why.
Yeah, but you've learned to trust your instincts, and 100%. That's a valuable thing. Mm-hmm. Most people don't. That's one of the things an artist has to know how to do is trust his instinct. All the best art is second nature. It's made by second nature. It's not made consciously in that way. That's why I say the goal of art is to create conscience, not consciousness.
Yeah. You know?
It's to create the thing where you feel the thing, where you empathize, where you say, yeah, that's right, that's true, or that's beautiful. You don't do that. That's not a conscious decision. It's an internal, instinctual decision.
Yeah. There was something that I noticed relatively early in the working with different artists that was interesting was one of the bands I worked with is called Slayer, heavy metal band. One of the inventors of black metal, or, you know, like very, very aggressive metal. And the lyrics were really dark and heavy. And to some people, they would look at that as negative content. And then I would go to a concert and I would see an arena full of kids who were very much like the guys in Slayer, who were so filled with joy listening to this music. It was speaking directly to them. It completely was nourishing them.
Right.
Kumbaya would not have reached them.
It would have just made them angry.
Yeah. So it's like, it's almost like beyond what the actual content is. It's more like, how does whatever the art is resonate with other people? And, you know, I personally don't like to see horror movies. I don't like to see images of violence at all, horror or violence or anything. So I almost never go to the movies other than maybe documentaries. But for some people, that experience of feeling the thrill, that really moves them. They like it. But again, I don't know that there's not a right and a wrong, and there's not a positive and a negative in it. It's more like it really is what entertains people, and whatever stuff happened in their life that led them to a place where this darker thing speaks to them, in their case, it's healing to hear it. They feel less alone.
Right. Yeah, that's right. That's, you know, I've called the new stuff I'm working on with Kefis and Jay, I've called it the invisible light. And I feel that it's because of that very thing you're talking about, because what it's saying, the words are very dark. The world it's talking about is very dark. But if you listen into it, there's a great deal of light, invisible light.
Yes.
Right?
Beautiful.
But you have to find your way into it. If you just take it all at face value, or if you try to approach it pedantically, you'll just say, well, this is a dark, dark world. Well, it is a dark world, but there's also, you know... there's all of that. There's the ocean and the trees and the sky.
And I think it's all, it's all, like I said earlier, I think it's all just a reflection of what's going on. You know, it's like, there's tremendous beauty in the world, and there's really bad stuff going
on.
And all of that warrants being reflected back.
It's interesting. You know, I've been going around recently, and most of the music I'm hearing in supermarkets and department stores and those things, just going around life, most of it that I'm hearing is from the 1960s. And I'm curious about that, because the 1960s were maybe the last time there was this sort of exuberance about art. Like, I was at Whole Foods the other day and they were playing Good Lovin' and I Want to Hold Your Hand and those kinds of songs. And it was it lightened the feeling in the in the place. And there really hasn't been that particular aspect of music since the 1960s that I can think of.
No, and it's also a time beyond what the lyrical content was, when the industry was still small and the stakes were low.
Yeah, that's right.
And the people making that music probably were making it for themselves or for their friends or for, you know, the high school dance. They weren't making it to sell out arenas because nobody had done that.
There wasn't an arena to play in.
Exactly.
It
seems that anything, when it starts, it's small and has beautiful intention and integrity in it. And then when it gets big and a lot of people are involved, that just dissipates, in any organization.
This is one of the reasons I love, as a producer, I love making first records with artists.
Yeah.
Because you're dealing with an artist who's been working under complete autonomy for a number of years. And he doesn't have experts telling him what the audience wants, for instance.
Yes.
So I've had several very successful first records with artists that were tremendous fun, and I still love today because of that. They're unself-conscious.
Yes, no baggage.
Right. Yeah.
I've worked with both artists for the first time, many artists and many successful artists and existing artists, and it's definitely true that with a new artist, there's a freedom of how is this going to work. Whereas with the established artist, there's also often a lot of bad habits to have to unlearn.
Just playing in front of 20 or 30,000 people will create some bad habits.
Does something to your brain.
Well, it can make you be too broad.
Yeah.
And in the studio, the studio is like a film, you get right in on a person. You're close, you're right by them. They're singing in your ear.
Yeah.
And in a large concert, it's like a theater. You're projecting out into the last row.
Yes.
So it's a very different discipline. And playing for large crowds and having to gin them up night after night can really give you some bad habits. On the other hand, working with seasoned artists can be absolutely the best because they're just good.
Absolutely. I was going to say, when you mentioned the work that I did with Johnny, and a lot of, especially in the beginning when we started working together, it was getting him to perform the songs less.
Yeah, right.
Sell the songs less.
Just to tell it.
Just tell me the story. And I said, I'm sitting right here next to you. And then we were sitting on a couch. Just sing me this. Just tell me the story of the song. You don't have to perform it. And there's recordings, because the tape was rolling all the time. And he would always say to himself, get off stage, Cash. Get off stage.
Yeah, he was a character, wasn't
Great
he?
Guy.
What a loss, tremendous loss
Beautiful
that
human
was.
Being.
Yeah.
Beautiful he human being.
He was amazing.
Yeah. I think he would have been, anything he would have done would have been good.
Yeah, that's right.
Because it was him. It wasn't that he was the best musician or the best singer. It was he showed through what he made. He chose that. But anything he would have chose would have been great.
You know, Sam Shepard and I were doing a play up in New York, Tooth of Crime, and he called me up to write music for it. And I was at a time in my life when I didn't know what music was anymore. I couldn't tell why one note should be here and another note shouldn't be there. You know, every note was the same and no notes were even notes. I was letting go of the idea of pitch entirely and just working purely off tone, and I was at sea. And I said, and we were sitting in a theater somewhere, and I said to Sam, I don't even know what music is anymore, man. And he said, well, when you do it, that's what it is. And that was the most freeing thing anybody ever said to me in my life.
Great.
And And that's what I think, that's the thing we can help artists get to that point. I want to help other artists with that same vote of confidence or that same lack of questioning.
We'll be back with more of Rick's conversation with T-Bone after this. We're back with more Rick Rubin and T-Bone Burnett.
What was your entry into music? I don't know any of it. I don't know. I mean, I've known you for so long, but that I know you as T-Bone Burnett. I don't know how you became T-Bone Burnett.
Well, my first entry into music was my parents had a great 78 collection. And I used to sit down and listen to all the Louis Armstrong records and Ella Fitzgerald, the Great American Songbook records.
Was this in Texas?
Yeah, in Texas, in Fort Worth. Mm-hmm. And I was moved by the way there was a song, there was a Cole Porter song, I think, called Begin the Begin.
Yeah.
You know that tune? And I'd listen to it and I'd be immediately transported to some tropical island somewhere. And I was amazed at the way music could create place, could create an atmosphere and an environment. And you could close your eyes and I would no longer be in Fort Worth, Texas, which was to me a great relief.
Yes.
Fort Worth at the time had a very low ceiling. Mm. And it felt like anything that was happening in the world was happening somewhere far away and there was no way to get there. Mm. But music was a window or a door out into these other places, into the world. And
was that that wasn't the music of the day though?
No, it wasn't. That was
old, you were listening to older, even then it was old music.
Yeah, yeah. It was old music then.
What was the music of the day when you were young?
Well, it was like Elvis Presley and Ricky Nelson. Mm-hmm. I loved Ricky Nelson. Mm-hmm. I loved Ricky more than Elvis because he was on television and he sang a great song every week. And I didn't really understand Elvis. He seemed broad to me.
Yeah.
Whereas Ricky was cool and understated, you know. Yeah. So my aesthetic sort of went that direction. I learned to appreciate Elvis, of course, much more later.
Yes.
When I got way into especially that stuff he did with Sam Phillips.
Yeah.
Who was also, wasn't Sam Phillips a great inspiration to you? I mean,
absolutely.
I feel like, you know, he was a guy who, like you, didn't recognize race boundaries. Sam Phillips was a great civil rights leader, actually. You know, he had the first all-woman radio station, WHER, in Memphis, and he brought Helen Wolf into the studio when Helen Wolf might have scared the pants off of most white people at the time. I mean, yeah. He was a big, tough, strong black man in the South, but Sam embraced him and embraced Ike Turner and brought all these incredible musicians into the studio and opened up the world to them and them to the world, you know.
Absolutely.
And I admire that you've done very much the same thing. You've crossed those boundaries.
And just naturally though, it's like I have eclectic tastes and I follow my taste and it's not, there's no political underpinnings.
No, but
you know, it's just
we also had Sam.
Yeah,
you know, to start it that way.
Yeah,
and John Hammond before him.
Yeah, even, right? John Hammond, incredible.
John Hammond was a uptown New York establishment guy who went down to the village and found Billie Holiday, and you know, music's always done that though. Music. The thing, Tony Bennett, you know, has an art school and he says the great thing about art, and he's a good painter, he's a very good painter, but he says the great thing about art is you're either good or you're not good. And it doesn't matter where you're from or what your ethnicity is or any of that. It's just good or not good.
And it feels like the relationships that I have with artists have nothing to do with anything other than our love of music. And it doesn't, you know, it doesn't matter where they're from or what the background is, or it doesn't matter.
It's like, right. That's
not, we're not talking about that. You know, we're talking about music.
That's right.
And we're either on the same page or not. And that's all. And that's good too. Like whether we are or not, it's all fine.
That's good. That's you know, fine. Like, exactly.
I'm not trying to, convince anybody of anything.
Yeah, that's right. Willie Dixon, I got to work with Willie Dixon.
Incredible.
And one of the things he would say is, if that's the way you like it, I like it.
Yeah.
And I loved that.
Yeah.
That's generous. That's a deep generosity, you know?
Yeah.
So
beautiful.
And he was.
Okay, so Elvis is on the radio and Ricky Nelson's on the radio.
Yeah.
You're listening to 70 big band 78s.
Yeah, stuff like that.
What was your first music related gig? And your first instrument?
One day I was at a friend's house and there was a Gibson guitar, much like this one, mm-hmm. leaning against a wall. And I hit the E string. I went like that and I went, oh. And it just something about hitting that one note was like a key that unlocked a door that led me through my whole life. And once I started playing guitar when I was about 12, I started listening to guitar players. And I learned how to play Wildwood Flower by the Carter family, which Maybelle Carter is essentially the mother of rock and roll guitar. You know, every rock and roll guitar player I know learned to play Wildwood Flower first or very soon thereafter. And so I started listening to the Carter family. And I started listening to Hank Williams and that stuff because it was on the radio. And there was a lot of interesting pop music. There was Peggy Lee was interesting at the time in the 50s. She was really killer great. Yeah. And then the Beatles happened, you know, and that changed everything. That really did. That changed the world. I look at those clips now, the Beatles playing for audiences of young girls, and the girls are screaming. And some of them look like they're screaming at a horror movie. And I feel like there was that confluence of events of the first Kennedy assassination and the Beatles coming out in the wake of that, that was once again, them
catharsis.
It was a catharsis in them mythologizing this horror for us in a beautiful way. And singing these joyful songs in the wake of this great tragedy, tremendous tragedy,
and again all unintentional.
Yeah,
you know, none of these, like again, looking back, we can see happened, and this was we can call it a reaction, but I don't think it was a intellectual reaction.
Not at all. No,
it just happened.
Nobody was connecting the two at the time, but I think in retrospect, it's hard not to connect.
Yeah,
them,
it's fascinating.
Right.
It's fascinating.
So, so those things, I mean, sometimes we can see around corners. I know you see around corners occasionally and you think, oh, I see where this fits and this works. I've had that happen a couple of times. But most of the time, I certainly didn't with Raising Sand, for instance. Yeah. I didn't see around that corner. I just thought, this is something to do.
It's just cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. These two sound good together.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
But
did you join a band?
Yeah. Then I was already in a little band and we were playing mostly surf music at the time because I got an electric guitar, I got a melody maker, and we were playing flat wound strings on a melody maker. And there were all those great surf tunes that had, they were all in the big string. Oh, I left out Jimmy Reed. Jimmy Reed for me was, that's actually probably ground zero. That's after I learned Maybelle Carter, I learned Jimmy Reed. And then that opened up a whole other world of R&B, deep R&B.
Great.
And
how old were you about this time?
Probably 12 or 13,
great.
You know. And the Beatles, actually, one of the things I loved about the Beatles was they sounded like Jimmy Reed. They played the low strings on the guitar. They played flat wound strings on the bottom of the guitar like Jimmy Reed. Mm-hmm. And he also, it was also just the groove, you know, the pocket. They played in a similar pocket to him. I feel like they must have listened to him. Once I got into Jimmy Reed, I devoured everything. I learned every possible song. Mm-hmm. And Chuck Berry.
Yeah.
That was the other cat.
The swing of the Beatles is undeniable.
Yeah.
People don't really talk about it.
Yeah.
The songs are so good.
The songs are killer, but, you know, and Ringo was, you know, he played with Sister Rosetta Tharpe when he was the house drummer. Yeah, when he was the house drummer at the Cavern Club, he played with all the R&B acts that would come through. So he got a real, he's probably just innate with him, but he swung so hard. And I was watching Ron Howard's documentary of 8 Days a Week about the Beatles. Yes. And I realized, oh, the three geniuses up front were killing, but Ringo was supplying, was
incredible.
All the electricity was coming out of Ringo. Absolutely. He was blowing everybody's mind without us even knowing it.
Yes.
Now, looking back on it, after all these years of, of listening to everything, I can see it. At the time, I couldn't. I love the way he, I love the way he attacked his hi-hat, for instance.
Yeah.
He just had it going solid. It wasn't, it was shh, you know. So that supplied a lot of electricity and excitement, but also just his.
Yeah, he put his whole self into it.
Yeah, his thing, you know. He would hit the bass drum, he'd go boom, you know, just like kill it. And the other cats were killing it too, but he was the really electric part of it, I thought. So when that happened, then you know, oh, the other guy before the Beatles was Buddy Holly, who they also wanted to be.
Yeah.
You know, we were playing
and
Buddy.
And he was also from Texas. So, so was there this feeling of
Yeah, definitely. He was one of the cats that made me feel like, oh, I can get out from under this low ceiling.
Yes.
If Buddy Holly could do it.
Yes.
You know, it's possible. Yeah.
That was T-Bone Burnett talking with my co-host Rick Rubin at Shangri-La in Malibu. His new album, Invisible Light, Acoustic Space, is out now and available wherever you get your music. You can also visit our website to find a Spotify playlist for the album, and also a playlist for some of our favorite T-Bone productions. Broken Record is produced by Justin Richmond and Jason Gambrell, with help from Mia Lobel, Jacob Smith, Julia Barton, and Jacob Weisberg. Special thanks to my co-hosts, Rick Rubin and Bruce Headlam. Our Broken Record theme music is by the great Kenny Beats. Be sure to check out his new album with rapper Rico Nasty. Also, be sure to check for next week's episode with Linda Perry. She talks with Bruce about being the first woman nominated for Producer of the Year at the Grammys in 15 years. That's next week. For Pushkin Industries, I'm Malcolm Gladwell.